All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and our next guest on the show today is Stephen Salisbury. He's a cultural writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer and a regular at Tom Dispatch, tomdispatch.com. His most recent book is Mohammed's Ghost, an American story of love and fear in the homeland. And he's got a piece today under Tom Engelhart's name at antiwar.com. That's Tom Dispatch, Tom Engelhart, you know, with Nick Terse. How to Fund an American Police State, Real Money for an Imaginary War, and also Weaponizing the Body Politic. It's got two titles like that, but you'll see why when you click on it. Stephen Salisbury today at antiwar.com. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
I'm good, Scott, and thanks a lot for having me back. It's great to be talking again.
Well, good. I'm very happy to have you here. Although it's bad news that brings us together. It's funny. It's already the future, kind of, really. You think about it, 2012. Think how much time has passed already since the terror war started. And I think we all kind of know that, well, like they say, everything changed, and that the drug war was only a dress rehearsal as far as getting the local sheriff's departments and city police agencies across the country armed up to, you know, one day be merged completely with Homeland Security as our national police force of tyranny and pain. But we really have come very far. And this article of yours, you really just chronicle, you know, 1,001 absolute, almost unbelievable outrages if you took them by themselves. You just say there is just no way that this is happening in America. But it just goes on and on. I'm not complaining. I'm just saying it's not about your writing, just the facts.
It is what it is.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
You know, we're a decade on from 9/11, and you're right. I mean, the drug war was a kind of a dress rehearsal, which is not to minimize the drug war at all, and the violence and armoring up that took place with the drug war as the root cause, but.
But, well, that's how a lot of this militarism is being used now, since there aren't any terrorists, but you got to drive your tank somewhere if you got a tank,
right,
I guess,
right.
And you're a deputy sheriff.
The big game changer has been the amount of money that the federal government has focused on Homeland Security and where that money is going and who's appropriating it. And I think the largest point of this piece is that it's not just the police that have been militarized, but the whole government at every level is involved. You know, from the feds who make the appropriations, to the states who sift through the grant requests, to the local councils and mayors and executives who make the requests in the first place, to the police who want to have what the police in the next county over have. And, you know, when you're talking the amounts of money that I lay out in this piece, you're talking an awful lot of hardware. Somewhere, no one is exactly sure, and it's almost impossible to pin it down, but somewhere between $600 and $700 billion has been funneled into Homeland Security by the federal government, and not just through the Homeland Security Department. That's just a part of it. It comes from dozens, literally dozens of departments and agencies of the federal government, and it goes, it flows through the body politic, and at every point along the way, people are representatives and voters are implicated in this process. I mean, we get what we pay for. I think I make that point. And this is U.S. taxpayer money that's now been turned into creating hundreds of military fiefdoms around the nation. I use this as an example: money that's flowed into Tampa, Florida, which is where the Republicans will be holding their convention this summer. And there was absolutely really no debate whatsoever about their desire to acquire a weaponized, armored Lenko Bearcat personnel carrier with, an inch and a half thick steel armoring and blast-resistant shields and turrets and all this stuff, and which will now join two other actual tanks that Tampa has, and to, you know, as a way of beefing up, if you want to put it that way, security for the Republican convention. And you know, the thing of it is that's not where it ends in Tampa for the convention. They are also at the same time, this isn't in the story, but they are also at the same time going to have on loan 12 other armored personnel carriers and tanks in order to turn back, I guess, curious citizens and pushy homeless people and any protesters that, you know, want to come out and speak their minds. I mean, after all, this is America. I mean, why should they be allowed to speak their minds? You know, and I was on the ground covering the conventions in 2004, both in Boston and in New York City. And there was a significant amount of equipment and weaponry and highly sophisticated police tactics that were in evidence then. But, you know, those are big places. New York City's a big place, and it kind of absorbs that kind of thing. You walk three blocks away from some, you know, incredible police bust of 1,000 people, and it's like it's nothing's happening. But in Tampa, you're going to be able to see just what this beefing up and armoring up really means to America. Mm-hmm. To an American city, an American place, and it has the potential to be really ugly.
Well, and I think, yeah, exactly. It's all about that potential, because we can all imagine what it would be like if, say, for example, the currency lost a lot more of its value all in a very short amount of time, something like that. And there, you know, Occupy protests look like nothing compared to the next wave of them, that kind of thing. You could have a lot of people killed by these cops and all their terrible equipment. I mean, for the most part, it's used on like SWAT raids against, you know, individual homeowners and renters at a time, that kind of thing.
Right,
but when all this very same stuff is deployed as, you know, with the riot police out there with the crowds, this could become, you know, pretty Syria looking pretty quick.
Well, the disturbing thing is, to me anyway, which is the point you just made, that when all this is deployed really in a political context, I get really antsy, because, you know, there's nothing, it's not illegal for people to speak up and assemble to express their grievances with the government. I mean, that's, I seem to have seen that somewhere. Where was that? What was the document, the founding document?
I don't know. Yeah, it couldn't have been anything from the history of this country.
You know, so, but it, not to make a joke out of it, but it is a lot of the security stuff that has been funneled all over the country. And we're talking communications gear, weapons, vehicles, massive amount of surveillance equipment and technology. All this stuff has been distributed in the name of, you know, the war on terror. Well, you know, guess what? There are no terrorists to speak of. This is equipment looking for a purpose, and the purpose is now clearly become, you know, as you pointed out, you know, so-called criminal raids, whether they're drug-related or eviction-related, and you know, serving warrants and suppressing political activity. That's
You have one example in here. You know, specifically tailored for the antiwar.com audience, I guess, but it's pretty important no matter who you are. When you say that Florida decided to launch investigations into supporters of Ron Paul, who, you know, he's not Lyndon LaRouche or whatever. Not that that would be justified at all, but he is not some crank. He's been in the Congress. He's been reelected to the Congress 12 times or something.
Right.
The House of Representatives never voted to expel him or anything. He's a member of the Republican Party in good standing. He's one of the surviving candidates for president after a grueling process here. This guy is as legitimate a presidential candidate as you could have, and yet for someone to support him is reason for them to be investigated. It's not just those SUV-burning hippies who are being targeted here. It's good Republicans who like that constitutional guy a little bit.
You make a very good point. I mean, once you deploy this stuff, it expands and becomes completely inclusive.
Yeah, it's crazy. You know, we were just talking about this with Glenn Greenwald, too, about how, you know, especially since it's mostly being used against Muslims, you do see examples of, well, wait, they do go after, you know, Earth Firster types with this. And they do go after, you know, they keep putting out these reports about, you know, right-wing extremist males with guns and the re-rise of the militia movement. That's not really happening, but they like to pretend it is and arm up against that and whatever. And we're all going to be crying, at least it ain't me, all the way to solitary confinement, you know?
Well, I think Glenn has pointed out, and many people have pointed out, that that the Patriot Act, when it was enacted, contained a clause defining something called domestic terrorism, and which was so loosely worded that it could be used and applied to virtually any kind of act of political dissidence, whether it's right, left, or just an angry citizen. And that's what's happened. I mean, you mentioned Muslims, so, which is something, an area that I've done a lot of reporting on. And really, if you look back over 10 years, there's been less than 200 American Muslims who have been convicted of some terrorist-related activity. And, you know, a lot of people would argue that those convictions were based on scenarios that were cooked up by law enforcement to begin with. But even nevertheless, even if they were, that's less than 200. If you expand it and say, well, okay, what about all these guys financing, you know, sending money out to Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda-related groups? Even if you include that, you're talking about 400 people. So in the course of the last decade, you have a federal government spending roughly $630 or $40 billion in order to ensnare a maximum of say, 600 people with terrorist-related convictions. Is that really what we ought to be using nearly $1 trillion for? It doesn't really make a lot of sense.
That's a whole other angle there. In fact, that's another article that we're running at antiwar.com today is the opportunity cost, the seen and the unseen. We don't know the kind of improvements in people's lives that could have been made with all this money, but we know that it didn't happen because this money went somewhere else. For example, slaughtering Iraqis and developing the technologies to enslave the Iraqis to such a degree that, and I was harping on this one earlier in the show, the retina scanners. This is one that's coming soon. It's been easy to see ever since they started taking our digital fingerprints just to get a driver's license, you know, 10 years ago or more, 15 years ago maybe, that this is where we're headed. And Raytheon just, you know, put out a commercial the other day. You know, it's basically a commercial for their stock, I guess. Raytheon, we're fighting for you, or whatever kind of thing. Protecting you and keeping you safe. And it features all their drones, and it shows an army soldier getting a retina scan from somebody with this handheld retina scanner. And this is the kind of thing that they deployed against Fallujans back in 2004 with the second Battle of Fallujah. And maybe the first one, I don't know, but at least back then. And yet, sooner or later, these things are going to be cheap enough. Raytheon's going to be pumping them out. Ben Bernanke's going to be printing the money to buy them all with, and they're going to be passing them out to all our local sheriff's departments. And now, oh, you don't really actually need your license and registration because we got it all in our database. All we need is a picture of your eyeball. And, you know, just, I don't know what's going to stop them. What, are they going to let us vote on it or something? It's on as soon as it's cheap enough, and that'll be a matter of a couple of years.
Well, there was letting us vote on it.
It's hilarious to even mention that, right?
Well, you know, there are communities that have banded together to oppose this kind of stuff. And I didn't get an opportunity to insert this in the story. There just wasn't enough space. But there's a little town up in New Hampshire, Keene, New Hampshire, and they got about $300,000 from Homeland Security to fight off the terrorist skiers, I guess. I don't know.
That's actually the home of this radio network, Keene, New Hampshire. That's
Keene,
where the Free Staters hail from.
There you go. Well, maybe that says it all right there. Anyway, well, then you know. I mean, Keene citizens got together and said that they didn't think that it was really an appropriate thing for the police to have a Lenco Bearcat armored personnel carrier, that there was really no purpose for it. And as far as I know, and correct me if I'm wrong, they've fought back that particular acquisition by the local police department.
I actually don't know how that was resolved or if it was resolved yet.
I don't think it has been.
They 16 years ago or so, two men used automatic rifles to rob a bank in Los Angeles. So
right.
All deputy sheriffs need tanks.
Well, that is, you know, but the logic doesn't even extend to that. The logic is that 10 years ago, nearly 20 men from the Middle East flew planes into the World Trade Center. That's why the LA police need to have those tanks and cameras and whatever.
Right.
I mean, that has been the drumbeat since September 12th. Never again will this happen in America. We're going to do everything we can to prevent it. And once you have that mindset, it flowed down. I mean, I watched it as a reporter here in Philadelphia, how federal, you know, local officials, largely with the Interior Department, absorbed that message and were afraid to do anything because if anything, even the slightest thing happened under their watch, they were terrified of that possibility. So the fear, there was real fear on September 12th in the federal government, and it was communicated throughout the federal bureaucracy.
Which is funny, because you would think that the lesson would be, wow, there's no accountability whatsoever. Even when the very worst thing ever happens on our watch, nobody gets in trouble. Nobody.
Right, well. That's a different lesson issue.
I would have learned if I was a bureaucrat. And actually, it seems like that's the lesson they learned here, is we can just steal whatever we want, we can kill whoever we want, we can entrap whoever we want, we can persecute whoever we want, we can seize whatever we want. Everything's changed, there's no more law, now we're just cops going fishing.
Well, I can tell you that that the fear at the highest levels of the government certainly was communicated all the way down the ranks, and I remember reporting on people who were picked up, you know, for just doing ordinary things like, you know, taking pictures and stuff like that, and they were hauled into, these are immigrants, hauled into immigration court, and were absolutely, and their hearings were sealed by federal order. I mean, they really had done nothing, and you couldn't find out anything about what had happened to them. They just simply disappeared, and you know, there wasn't all immigration agents or the FBI or any other law enforcement agency had to do, or any prosecutor, was say the word terrorism, and judges had absolutely no qualms about, you know, going along with whatever the prosecutors or agents wanted them to do. Mm-hmm. It was really a remarkable period. And don't forget also that the people have different views about immigration, but the courts, immigration courts, are not part of the criminal justice system. They're actually administered by the Justice Department itself, and are essentially civil courts. And so, any strictures that come down from the top of the Justice Department, in those days it was Ashcroft, they just went right down to the judges as well. The judges didn't base decision, at least in some cases, did not base their decisions on law or rules, but on what the administrative order from the Attorney General was. That's whatever you think about immigration, that's not exactly what you want to find in an American courtroom.
Mm-hmm. Well, the guys in the chat room say that the latest news on Free Talk Live is that the Bearcat is coming to Keene, despite all the protests. And that really kind of goes to, it's a great article. Again, it's Weaponizing the Body Politic under Tom Englehart's name by Stephen Salisbury today at antiwar.com. And it's in pieces here. We have all the militarization. Then we have, as you mentioned, all the fusion centers and all the integration of the different levels. I mean, there was a time where you could honestly say there were 18,000 separate police agencies with separate jurisdictions in this country. Now that's very much more marble caked than it was even 10 years ago, as they say, with all those jurisdictions overlapping and the multiple jurisdictional task forces and terrorism task forces and whatever. But then you also have, after the decade of this, you have what Terry Liberty Parker used to always call the chilling effect, where people now actually just sort of assume that if they Google something controversial, maybe they will draw the attention of the government, and maybe they just don't want to bother with that. They've got responsibility. So why, if we are moving into a real police state here, why pick a fight with Big Brother? Maybe just go ahead and don't bother even trying to oppose it, because you're already beaten. People are already making those decisions when it comes to, I want to read this or I want to read that. There are people who say, I'm afraid to direct my browser to something called antiwar.com. What if one day that becomes a real liability that I ever did that? That kind of really happens. And like, for example, too, I wonder, and I don't know, but what do they tell the seventh graders about this? This is all perfectly normal. This is the homeland. And so where if we just have a single national police force, Gestapo, that, connects your retina scan and your license plate to your IRS record or whatever, and we're all just enslaved completely in with real-time surveillance and all this, where it'll all just seem normal to them now. They won't even know to object that there's anything objectionable happening, I guess.
Well, you mentioned General Dynamics, or Raytheon before, but... Department of Homeland Security has a $12 million contract with General Dynamics, which calls for General Dynamics to monitor the internet and social media, looking for information and names and so forth that connected to comments that are critical of the government. And although the department denies this, it's actually in their guidelines for the for social media monitoring. So any comment about the Department of Homeland Security or terrorism or anything like that is automatically swept up by General Dynamics and funneled to the Department of Homeland Security, where it goes into a database.
Right. Self-preservation is their first priority, just like the FBI, just like every other person or group of individuals you can find.
But they've been very clear about where they think the key mistakes were that led to 9/11, and probably at the top of the list is there has been the fragmented nature of intelligence and investigations and the inability to share information. So all this stuff goes to cure, if you want to use that term, cure that problem. Right. And they've gone a long way towards it, too.
Actually, the problem was the centralization of authority. Colin Rowley should have been able to make the call to go to the judge to search Moussaoui's belongings and stop the plot. But anyway. All right, well, out of time. Thank you so much. It's Stephen Salisbury from the Philadelphia Inquirer, TomDispatch.com, antiwar.com.
Thanks, Scott.